Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robin Hood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare collectible and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Thank you, Marshall. We're going to depart today's program and not talk about a theater issue, which there's not much to talk about these days. But as you know, on Off Script, once in a while, we do talk to authors about books, in most cases, books that relate to the listening area. And we have such a book today. On the Saturday evening of July 21st, 2007, Tom Drew, a 91-year-old man, attended by a caretaker at home, went missing from his home in a secluded area of Salisbury, Connecticut, never to be found. His disappearance has never been solved. His daughter, Allison Drew, has written a book about her father's disappearance, the investigation of it by the Connecticut State Police, and her struggle to find answers to the mystery. The book, called Searching for My Missing Father, an American Noir, is as much a harrowing tale of an unsolved mystery as it is a searing portrait of someone left behind by the unsolved disappearance of someone they love. Welcome, Allison, and thanks for joining me on Off Script.
Well, thanks. Thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
I almost want to say congratulations about the book because it is so well written and it observes a lot of the intriguing elements of an unsolved mystery. But to say congratulations almost seems trite because, on the other hand, it's really a profoundly personal memoir of your journey in the last 13 years to deal with this kind of tragic disappearance. So I say congratulations with those kinds of qualifications. Before we get into the specifics of the disappearance of your father, Tom Drew, when you heard about his disappearance from the caretaker who lived with him, you were living in England,
yes,
and you still are. And I ask you that because before we get into your father's story and yours, tell us about your background and how you got to live in London, in England rather, and do what you do as a professional occupation.
Well, I'm an academic, although I'm retired, but I still research. I'm retired from my day job, as they say. My interest in academic research actually started off when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Ghana. The late 1970s, I became interested in Africa, and I became more and more fascinated by African history, the impact of colonialism, and so on. And then later on, I decided that I would do a master's in African studies. This was at UCLA, University of California, Los Angeles. And then I liked academic research, so I decided to carry on. And I did then a master's in political science and a PhD in political science. My doctoral thesis was on South African politics.
So you were living, I think, in England at the time. And on Sunday morning, July 22nd, 2007, you get a call from the caretaker that says your 91-year-old father, Tom, is missing. Let's back up a little bit before we get into your reaction when you got that news. How did your father and your mother, I gather, come to live in Salisbury?
Well, they retired. My father retired, in particular, he wanted to live in the country. He had grown up on a farm, and I think that he wanted to live in the country, well, to get away from the urban rat race of his profession, but also because he loved nature. He loved cultivating plants, vegetables, and flowers. I think they both wanted a simple and quiet life.
And they both had sophisticated careers in Manhattan.
Yes, yes. Well, my mother was an artist, and then later she worked as an interior decorator.
And your father?
He was a fashion designer.
Mm-hmm. So they came to Salisbury in what year?
About 1980.
Okay. And they lived, describe the property on which they lived and the house that they built.
Okay. Well, it's a house that's set on 13 and a half acres. It was built in a French colonial style. They themselves actually designed the house. My mother drew up the plans because her interior decoration work gave her some background in developing house plans. And I remember seeing them together when I was already, I think in my 20s, with their heads put together going over these plans. It was French colonial in style. To me, it was really beautiful. It was personally my dream house, really, set in a big meadow, which my father mowed. So the house had a very large lawn, and it was surrounded by trees on all sides.
And it abuts the Massachusetts-Connecticut state line.
The border, the northern border, is the Massachusetts Conservation Road, okay. which is the state line as well.
And your mother predeceased your father?
Yes, by quite a long time. She died in 1984 of cancer.
Okay. So let's now go to the night of your father's disappearance, or the morning after, when you were in England, and you get the call from one of the caretakers who says, your father's disappeared. What was your first reaction?
Well, I'm not sure that I really understood the meaning of what he was saying. I sat up, I was in bed, it was very early. I sat up and I said, well, he must have, I said, did you check the vegetable garden? He must have gone in there and fallen. There was a fenced vegetable garden at the back of the house. So that was my first reaction. Yeah. I couldn't really comprehend it. I couldn't comprehend the notion of missingness.
Okay. Before we get into more of the details of what happens next, some of the listeners to this program, I included, would remember your father. And I have some very, very fond memories of him. Mostly I saw him in the old Salisbury Pharmacy or at the post office. And he always had a very kind, very kind of gentle, very kind of sweet disposition, very kind-hearted and friendly to certainly me and in my observation of him, everyone else. Now, that's the point of view of someone who just had a village passing association with him. As one of his two daughters, describe him for us. His stature, his disposition, his personality?
Well, he was a perfectionist in many ways, but he did love living in the country. He loved knowing people. He was a very social man. At the same time, he loved working in the garden. And the garden and the design of his flower gardens, which were very formal, became an extension of his artistic bent. He loved to draw, and he was constantly sketching. Not only was that part of his professional life, and he worked on the weekends when he was employed. He had a little studio and would sketch designs and so on. But even afterwards, I would always find little sketches of plans for gardens or plans for needlepoint designs and so on. So he had a drive to express himself by visual creativity, through using his hands.
Right.
So that to me was a very striking feature.
In case you're just joining us, the program is Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer, and today we're talking about a new book written about a very famous occurrence, actually, that happened in Salisbury within the last 15 years. The book is called Searching for My Missing Father, an American Noir, and it's the story of the disappearance of Tom Drew back in 2007, written by his daughter, Allison Drew, who is our guest today. So you get on a plane from England, you come to the United States, and you immediately confer with one of the caretakers of two of your father, who happened to be the last people who saw him alive.
Yes, the last.
Can you, and I should say, in reading the book, you have named these people by a fictional first name.
Yes.
Okay, so if you could tell us why you did that, and what ensued when you happened back to your house when your father had been gone missing.
Well, of course, we don't really know what happened, and I want to respect people's privacy. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily think that specific personalities are the point here. I'm more focused my concern is really the police investigation and how they handled what they were told by the different individuals. But when I first arrived at the house, I was still thinking that any day I was accepting the possibility that he had left on foot, as I was told, and that he would simply show up. I thought maybe he left on foot, and then he collapsed in the woods very close to his house, and that we would find him very shortly. So, and for the first week, each day when I came back to the house, we would always, I would go and check the phone or ask, has there been any news? But when I went into the house, I entered through the garage into the library, and I went out of habit to the phone where we had a caller ID. And I was taken aback to see that the caller ID for July 21st and 22nd had been deleted. So we had the days for July 20th. We had the incoming calls listed, and then we had the incoming calls for the Monday, the 23rd, but not 21st and 22nd, the Saturday and the Sunday. And that really shocked me, because I knew that there had been calls. And I asked my sister and the live-in senior companion, and they didn't know anything about that. So that was the first thing that struck me as extremely bizarre.
The name of the live-in senior companion that you give in the book is called?
Matt.
Matt, okay. And there was a temporary companion with your father the evening of the disappearance.
Yes, Pamela.
And Pamela is there.
Yeah.
What did Matt, the live-in companion, have to say? What did Pamela, the contemporary or the temporary caretaker, who was, I gather by the story, the last to see him, have to say?
Mm-hmm. Well, Matt simply relayed what Pamela had said. And she said that they had been watching TV. They had had dinner. They had watched TV. And at about 7:15, he got up and said, I've got to get going. And then he came back in. He left the room. He came back in, she said, wearing a tan jacket. And he sat for a few minutes, and then he left. And she then continued watching TV. And then she said after about 5 or so minutes, maybe 10 minutes, she went and looked for him. She thought he was upstairs using the bathroom. And then she realized he wasn't in the house. And then she went outside and looked around. And then just at that moment, the senior companion and his the live-in senior companion and his girlfriend drove up.
And when did the state police arrive on the scene to investigate?
They arrived. They were called at 8:14 p.m. that same evening, mm-hmm. and they arrived about less than 15 minutes later. They had a trooper in town, and he came out. So it takes slightly less than 15 minutes to get from the middle of town to my father's house.
And all the while, were there canvases of people going through the woods and up and down the roads looking for your father?
The three individuals before they called the police, the two employees and the girlfriend, they looked for about 45 minutes, and then they called the police. Hmm. And then when the police when the trooper came, he went out with the living companion, and they walked down. Yeah, Matt. And they walked down the Massachusetts Conservation Road, this dirt road. But they didn't see any signs that anyone had passed. It was still fairly light, but he also had a flashlight. He made some calls, and they started a process of calling my father's neighbors, those who were on the road and very close by, to see if anyone had seen an old man.
Your father was 91 years old. As I recall, he was of slight stature.
Yes.
I always saw him as a fit, though slightly statured
yes.
gentleman. 91 years old. How far do you think he could have walked on his own? Either on an open road or in thick woods that I gather surround most of the house.
Yes, especially in July, at the peak of the summer. He, in his last year, he was fit, but in his last year, he had gotten much frailer. His memory was declining gradually, but still it was continuing to decline that last year. He had fallen, so he had more difficulty walking. He, at the time that he vanished, he was dragging one of his legs, I was told. And then, as well, he had severe cardiopulmonary disease. So by the time, there's a little footbridge, or no, a little vehicle bridge that leads onto my father's, or what was then my father's property. And perhaps that's about 100 yards away from the house. And by the time he would get to that bridge, he would be red in the face and panting. And several people told me that. So he really could not walk far. And he also walked very slowly.
Mm-hmm. So
I don't think he could have walked far.
He could not have.
I don't think so.
You don't think he could. I don't know how to ask this question delicately, but I'm just going to ask it. When someone has someone they know who goes missing, when do you certainly not give up hope, but when do you accept the fact that it's doubtful that if found, the person who's gone missing will not have survived?
Well, with an elderly person, and especially an extremely old person as he was, that's always a high risk. And I could have coped with that. Of course, I would be sad. It would be a loss. I would grieve. For example, if he had simply gone out on the Massachusetts Conservation Road and enjoyed that walk, even for 5 minutes, if he had managed to do that, and if he had come home and collapsed, I think that would have been a good way to die. He loved that road, and he loved being in nature. So okay. if, for example, that's what happened, I would be at peace with that. As long as we found his body, that was the key thing.
Okay.
But in any case, I thought for several days, it was very possible he might have been alive, or even longer. But I have presumed for a very long time that he is deceased.
Okay. And when did the, either in cases like this or in the case of your father, when does the state police conclude that the person who's gone missing has no longer survived? Is there a standard operating kind of procedure for that determination?
No. What we are looking for is a body. so that he can be buried according to his religious and personal preferences. So no, the police don't come to a conclusion that he must have died on a certain date, not unless there's evidence to indicate that. Their aim in a missing persons case, in my opinion, should be to find the person, whether they are dead or alive. And with a very elderly person, it would presumably they would be dead.
In case you're just joining us, my guest is Allison Drew, and she's the daughter of Tom Drew, who was a 91-year-old man who lived in Salisbury, in a up by the state line in a very wooded area. And he just disappeared the evening of July 21st, 2007, while in the care of a companion or a temporary caretaker who was staying with him at the time. We're talking to Allison Drew about the disappearance and the ensuing Connecticut police investigation. So the state police conclude, from a practical point of view, you from an emotional point of view, that your father is likely deceased at this point. When did, in this case, the state police cease looking for a body? Or to put the question another way, how long did they continue to look for a missing body?
Well, they continued for quite a long time, and I hope that they will still continue. It's still, and as far as I am aware, it's open. The case is mm-hmm. open, but that becomes, periodically they look at the file and see if there's any new evidence, and that can often be a very pro forma action. But throughout the summer, the state police or the Connecticut Canine Search and Rescue, who were operating there at the behest of the state police, they continued the whole summer, and then also the Connecticut Canine Search and Rescue came back the next year and did more searches in different areas, and over a number of years they searched the area very, very thoroughly. And there was no sign of my father's remains above ground.
You're very critical of the conduct of the Connecticut investigation by the state police. Mm-hmm. At what point, either in how they dealt with the disappearance of the telephone call, the record of the telephone calls, or in the way they interviewed the caretakers who last saw him, at what point did you lose faith in the competence of the Connecticut State Police?
It was a slow process.
Yeah, I guess because it is a long story, I guess let me rephrase the question. When did you first say, aha, something's really not proceeding the right way here?
Well, very early on, for example, there was the issue of the alleged jacket that my father had on when he allegedly walked out of the house. And the woman claimed he put on a tan jacket and then left.
The woman being the woman being Pamela, who was with him when he disappeared.
And I only learned that Thursday evening after the disappearance.
This is five days after he disappeared.
Yes, I arrived in the U.S. on Tuesday morning, because there was only one flight a day, I think, from Manchester at the time. And so I was only able to pin down the detective and ask him exactly what did she say on the Thursday evening. And that's when she said he was wearing a tan jacket. So I got off the phone and I immediately went downstairs and I opened the closet and I saw that there was no jacket missing as far as I was aware. And I called my sister who was there, Bettina, and also Matt. And I said, what jacket was he wearing? And Matt said, well, I just presumed, she said he was wearing a jacket, so I presumed that was the case. But the police didn't check. And quite frankly, I've thought this many times, Lieutenant Columbo of the well-known TV program, he would have immediately checked. So, I mean, that kind of thing, things like that kept happening. But nonetheless, I knew that the police were trying hard, and I felt that they wanted to solve the case and find him. So I don't expect perfection. And I know sometimes there is a bit of trial and error. You learn as the case unfolds. So really, by the end of the summer, I asked the detective, isn't it possible that he was driven off? And he said, yes. And, you know, he looked a bit shamefaced, like he could not meet my eyes.
Now, when you talk about the possibility that your father had been driven off the property, you do, in several points in the book, make the point that they failed to fully examine the vehicle of one of the caretakers. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it was the first night, and the police asked Matt to open his trunk, and he did. And then they asked the woman, Pamela, but her trunk was locked. It couldn't be opened for some reason. That's what I learned. So they didn't do a thorough search. But we don't know who was there that day. There could have been other people. I mean, someone could have had a friend over. We don't know.
Do you have any indications based on some of the phone records that you otherwise were able to get that there was communication with other people between Pamela and some of her family members, I think, the afternoon of or before your father's disappearance?
Yes.
Isn't that the case?
Yes, indeed. Actually, there was a mystery call on Friday, late Friday afternoon for 16 minutes. And I've never been able to figure out, I traced the number, the police didn't, but I've never been able to figure out who was spoken to. So that's one question mark. But also there were two calls, there were a couple of morning calls made from my father's house to the relatives of the woman employee. And then there were two calls around one or two or so in the afternoon. And then during the first summer, two witnesses stated that, in fact, that they had heard that Tom Drew was missing much earlier, and they needed help to find him.
Okay.
And then the following year, two more witnesses came forward, and they said that they did not, I believe, know about the first two witnesses, but they said virtually the same thing.
We are talking with Allison Drew, who's written a book about the disappearance of her father, Tom Drew, back in July 21st, 2007 in Salisbury, Connecticut. Allison, thank you for joining me. This concludes the first part of our interview. We're going to pick up part two in a few minutes. If you've enjoyed this program, please listen in for part two of our continuing conversation with Allison Drew. And as always, if you like what you hear on WHDD Robin Hood Radio, please go to its website, robinhoodradio.com. Go to the support page and express your appreciation. I'm Dan Dwyer. Thanks for listening to us on Off Script.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.